Welcome to The Buzz That Was, the podcast that dishes ironic stories about iconic stars. You're not going to want to miss this.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I feel better. I'm still a little nasally,
and you're kind of coughy still.
Yeah.
But you do look better. You have a little color in your face.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
At least I don't feel or look like shit.
No. Not this week.
Yeah, thanks.
Last week, though, you were, like, in the depths.
Of looking like shit?
No, of your sickness.
Oh.
Yeah, so.
That's a nice friend way of saying, you look like crap, and.
Well, you looked like death. A little bit. But.
In a good way.
But in the best way. You had a lot of spirit. You were excited to be here.
Yeah.
You just didn't look like it.
That's it.
Oh, so.
So glad it's the weekend.
I know, right? TGIF.
Yes. Well, in case anyone was ever curious, we mostly record this on Friday nights.
And then again on Saturday nights.
And sometimes on Sunday.
Sometimes on Sunday afternoon.
Depends on how drunk Emily gets.
Or the microphones have been a problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's other reasons.
Tonight's a once and done night.
Yeah, we're going to do it in one take.
No editing.
No editing.
Until I start coughing.
Right, except for that. I'm Emily.
And I'm Chas.
Welcome back to The Buzz That Was.
What are we on, number five?
Number five this week. Do you have any buzz that wasn't?
I don't.
I don't either. Maybe we did really good on our research last week.
Go us.
I know, we're getting smarter by the podcast.
We're learning.
Other bit of business we need to attend to is the prize winner.
Oh, yes.
So we put names in a hat. Thank you all for sharing.
Yep.
And, okay, let's be real. Only two of you shared. But we still, nevertheless, put you in a hat. And the winner of our prize is Denise.
Woo, Denise.
Denise, thank you so much for sharing our page. Tell her what she's won.
Denise, you have won a magical shot glass.
It's magical?
Yeah.
Well, it is.
I could not come up with the right adjective.
Because it's
so good.
Is adjective
even the right English word to use?
Because it's so good. No, it is cool, though. No, I engraved a shot glass with our podcast name.
Yeah.
The buzz that was.
Emily's pretty crafty.
So, well, is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Someone at work did send me a little meme today that said, I could have bought this at the store for $7, but I spent $95 in craft supplies.
That is so true.
And I was like, yes, that is me.
You know, and it's usually about the journey, not the destination.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter. I mean,
it's about like, that 10 hours that you spend on this little picture frame.
Exactly. So congratulations, Denise.
Yes. We'll put a picture up on our Facebook page.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to take a picture. The shot glass is really cool. It's a long, skinny shape. And the buzz that was looks cool on there, but you have to, in order for it to be a picture, oh, maybe I could do a panorama. Would that work?
Maybe.
Because it's rounded, so you can't take a straight-on picture. You can't see everything. But nevertheless, we'll get a picture up there. We'll figure it out. And again, guys, thank you so much for listening.
Yes, thank you.
Both of you. In fact, actually, I know that Renee, my mom, was one of the ones that shared it. And I also know for a fact, and so do you, that she doesn't listen.
Not yet.
So we know for sure Denise listened.
Yes.
Or at least likes our Facebook page.
True.
And that's all that we can ask for, really. Just come out and listen, or don't.
Whatever you guys want to do. Then they're not going to be hearing this right now. So.
Well, then, you know, I don't have to cut out so many names.
There we go. So, should we
get started?
Yeah.
This week, we're going to talk about two comedy geniuses. I'm talking about John Belushi.
And I'm talking about Chris Farley.
This should be good.
Yes. Especially because Chris Farley idolized John Belushi,
mm-hmm.
and they have a very eerie, similar bio. They both worked on SNL. They starred in movies, battled obesity and had out-of-control lifestyles, and they both died at the age of 33 of drug overdoses.
And that's just to name a few. I mean, there are a lot. I mean, even down to their performance style, like, they're both so big and loud, and they're both such physical actors. It's just, it's so similar.
Well, Lorne Michaels, from the producer of SNL, he had said that when Chris Farley first came to the show, that if John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd had a child, that it would have been Chris.
It would have been him?
Yeah.
That's cool.
So, I was thinking maybe you could go first since John died first?
Yeah. He was like the leader of this kind of cult classic comedy. He's, you know, right. And Chris Farley very much idolized him. But before we get into that, we need a drink.
Shot time.
Shot time. So this week, what we've chosen is liquid cocaine.
Yeah. Very fitting.
I don't think that needs an explanation. Not by the end of this, anyway. And what's in it is we've got rum 150 proof, rum. And Chaz just made a face. Jägermeister. Rumpelmints. Yeah, that's disgusting. Rumpelmints.
I do like me some Rumpelmints.
And Goldschlager.
At least I'll have some cinnamon minty breath when we're done with this.
I know, right? Since we're talking in the same microphone, I really do appreciate that. No, I'm kidding.
Let's get buzzed.
Let's get buzzed.
Ew. That does not taste like the stuff I get at the bar.
It hurts to breathe.
Ooh. I feel like
we might switch it up for our second shot. No, I made a whole batch of it.
That's fine. I got good breath.
We'll just, it does feel refreshing.
Yeah.
It feels like kind of like I brushed my teeth.
I was going to say, I felt like I just went and swished some
mouthwash around. But it also burns.
Well, maybe it'll clear out my sinuses.
Hopefully, yeah. Not good for your kidneys, but good for your sinuses.
There we go. So, should we get into the story?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. John Belushi was born in Chicago on January 24th, 1949. He was one of four children born to Agnes and Adam Belushi, and Adam Belushi was a restaurant owner.
What kind of restaurant did John's dad own?
I don't know. I didn't look into it that
deep. One with food.
Probably one with food. Yeah. I bet they had a menu and then somebody to cook that, whatever they ordered.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Which is kind of funny because when John was on SNL, he did this bit about it was like a cafe or diner. It was a diner, and people would come in and they would order like potatoes and steak and or whatever they were.
Spaghetti and meatballs.
But no matter what they ordered, John Belushi was the guy taking the order, and he would yell back, "Cheeseburger and fries!" Like, no matter what they ordered.
That's funny. I mean, who doesn't want, like, a good cheeseburger and fries?
The people that want the steak and the potatoes. So I wonder if he got that from kind of watching, growing up in a restaurant.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
His mom, Agnes, was the daughter of Albanian immigrants, and Adam was an Albanian immigrant himself, so he was Albanian. His younger brother, you've probably heard of, Jim Belushi.
Yes.
Also an actor. Pretty big in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Kind of faded out in the 90s. But he was a good actor. Mm-hmm. I liked him. John, always a joker, had an interest in comedy from an early age. And his shenanigans in school caused, you know,
A ruckus
in the classroom. Yeah, he was the class clown, basically. During his high school years at Wheaton Central High, which is a suburb of Chicago. He became the All-American boy when he was the co-captain of his high school football team.
Go Wheaton.
He's a tiny little man, but he was big. He was robust.
Yes.
He was also elected homecoming king his senior year.
Oh, so he was popular.
Yeah, well, of course, because he's funny, and everybody likes funny people. During high school, he developed an interest in acting and appeared in the high school variety show. His drama teacher encouraged him to put aside his plans to be a football coach, because I guess that's what he originally wanted to do, to take up a career in acting. So she, like, saw something in him.
What a great teacher. I mean, telling him to go for his dreams.
Absolutely. She probably didn't do it with everybody, though. I mean, John Belushi was a class act.
Yes. I hope he thanked her one day.
Oh, I'm sure he bought her, like, a sports boat or something.
Or maybe sent her a letter.
Something. And maybe an autographed
headshot. Thanks, teach.
He also met his future wife and only wife when he was in high school, Judith Jacqueline. In the fall of his freshman year at the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater, John changed his image into a bad boy appearance by growing his hair long and having problems with discipline and not going to classes and that
kind of thing. What a rebel.
Yeah, he's such a rebel. He dropped out of Wisconsin and spent the next 2 years at the College of DuPage, a junior college near his parents' home in Wheaton, around where he went to high school. John helped found the West Compass Players, an improv comedy troupe that took after Chicago's famous Second City Ensemble. Mm-hmm. They performed 8 times a week. John later said that the audience expected the comedians to fail a third of the time.
Well, I mean, you can't be 100% perfect all the time.
Right. And so he said that you had to learn to write on your feet. And rather than expecting him to fail, the audience loved John, and he succeeded in upstaging all the other performers. As he grew into his 20s, John was drawn more and more into the comedy profession. And in 1971, he made the leap to the famous Second City stage in Chicago, where he performed 6 nights a week.
And you know what's weird?
What?
Is, I was going to talk about this later, but Chris Farley found a pair of John Belushi's boots at Second City, and he wore them nonstop for 2 years.
Oh, yeah. He had a hard-on for Belushi, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
That's cute.
No.
Second City was like it was kind of the same thing. I mean, it's still in Chicago. You can still go, and it's these, new and upcoming comedians that are trying to
make their name in the world.
Yeah, and there was a show called SCTV, so they made their skits into a TV show, and it was actually, I think it came out a year after SNL, so 76. Mm-hmm. My mom loved it. She watched it all the time, so I kind of grew up watching Belushi on SCTV.
Mm-hmm. And that's fun.
And all those other greats. In 1972, John and Judy moved to New York, and he started appearing off-Broadway in National Lampoon's Lemmings. In 1973, he was hired as a writer for the National Lampoon Radio Hour. The program was a hit and gave them enough security to settle down and marry, which they did on New Year's Eve in 1976.
He
wanted to give Judy fireworks.
Aww, for the new
cute.
Year.
Yeah.
So I guess I didn't realize that National Lampoon was like its own
thing. Oh my God, I had no idea. Okay, so I grew up watching National Lampoon's Vacation.
Yep.
And it always, in my head, what's National Lampoon? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I just thought, I don't know, that was that family or something.
Until the next one comes out, and then the next one comes out. Because National Lampoon did Animal House. And then they did, I don't know, it was all very confusing. I didn't get it. But, and I'm not going to talk about it a lot, but there is a new documentary on Netflix that is called Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead. And it's about National Lampoon and how it came to be. Yeah, it was a magazine, then it became a radio show, and then they actually did their, this is kind of interesting, they did their own TV show for a while there, and then Lorne Michaels called up and got John Belushi, Chevy Chase, like all the big hitters, mm-hmm. and said, do you want to do the show for us? And so National Lampoon lost all its good actors and SNL started.
I know you have told me about that before,
it's
so I
super
definitely
good movie.
Yeah, need to go check it out.
It's a really good movie. You guys should go watch it. The show SNL, it spawned the careers of such greats as Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase, and it was a super, super good outlet for John's comedic mm-hmm. craziness.
I mean, they have scripts, but they get to be creative and...
Oh, yeah. No, they write this stuff, though. I mean, I'm sure they had writers that helped, but they all kind of wrote their own skits. That's kind of how they
got started in the business?
Yeah, they brought their own material. So thanks to Saturday Night Live, John became really, really, really good friends with Dan Aykroyd, who later explained how they developed their most successful act, the Blues Brothers. I think right now, Hulu, if you're on Hulu, you can go back and watch the first several seasons of the Saturday Night Live, and you can go on there and see John's Samurai Warrior or that guy from the diner.
Oh.
Apparently, on the very first day that John and Dan met, they went out for a drink and got to talking about music. And John was really into, like, punk and heavy metal, and Dan was really into, like, blues. So he made John listen to some blues music, and that night is when they came up with the Blues Brothers.
Oh, they started their little bromance.
They were such good friends. Kind of like Chris Farley and David Spade.
Yes. But Chris was so mean to David.
So the friendship reminds me of kind of you and I. Like, you are the Dan Aykroyd and the David Spade of the situation. I am the Chris Farley and the John Belushi.
Because you're crazy sometimes?
And I do everything in excess. And you're the logical. I'm the fun.
Yeah.
You're the fun, too. I'm not saying that. But and there's not much logic over
Let's
here.
See. She's already said I look like crap last week, and I'm no fun.
And you're a party pooper. I just mean, you party, and then you know when it's done to party, and I just want to keep partying.
That is a true statement.
So, the Blues Brothers was a regular fixture of Saturday Night Live, and then it grew into such a phenomenon that in 79, so 3 years later, John and Dan quit SNL to pursue quote-unquote other projects. Basically, this whole Blues Brothers franchise.
Right.
They released an album of their hits before making the Blues Brothers movie, which was released in 1980. It was about this time, the Blues Brothers time, that John's drug use began escalating.
Well, I mean, he probably had more money.
Well, and in the 70s, cocaine wasn't really thought of as bad. I mean, it was good. I mean, everybody used it. Dan Aykroyd here in a minute talks about, there's a quote that he does it too. I mean, but John just loved it and couldn't get enough of it. He was addicted.
Yeah.
It helped him be more silly, probably helped him hurt less when he would crash into things. Okay, so Dan's quote was, "We had a budget in the movie for cocaine for night shoots." So they like put it in their budget. He said, "Everyone did it, including me, but John, he just loved what it did. It sort of brought him alive at night. A superpower feeling where you start to talk and converse and figure you can solve all the world's problems." That does sound fun. There was one time during the making of Blues Brothers when John, like, disappeared. Dan found him in a stranger's house that was near the set. He knocked on the door and he's like, "We're looking for one of our actors." And the guy was like, "Oh, you mean Belushi? He came in here about an hour ago and raided my fridge. He's asleep on the couch."
That's funny. He showed up at my door and raided... I mean, it's the 70s. I would have let him in.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, nowadays, if someone came knocking at my door, I'd probably wouldn't let them in.
And he must have known who the guy was.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's been
Because he's
TV.
Like, "Oh, Belushi? Yeah, that guy?
Yeah. He ate all my food. He's sleeping on my couch."
Yeah, he's been there before. On stage, it seemed that John was a carefree soul who never had a problem in his life. But as is the case with most comedians, behind his funny, loving persona on screen lay a troubled man. It sounds so Ernest Hemingway. He was admired by many for the fact that he was a little overweight and average looking, and yet still a huge star. Though while these things inspired others, sadly, they were the very things that John worried about to the point of despair. He hated the pressure of his career. He hated the way that people were constantly telling him what to watch and to watch what he said.
Well, I mean, he was always in the public eye.
I know. And the people that he worked for depended on him not being fucked up and falling down. And
right.
You know, but that pressure just... it got to him, and ironically made him the opposite. The idea of being restricted was taking its toll, so it made him do drugs to escape that, which is exactly opposite of what they wanted him to do.
And that's pretty much the same with Chris. Like, when he was a child, kids made fun of him, and so he just wanted to be funny.
Yeah.
That got him friends.
Exactly. John's drug taking was so extreme that when making the movie Animal House, the director, John Landis, observed that he was abusing his body in ways that would kill bulls. That's what he said. His friends, like Dan, also became concerned, especially when John claimed he disliked himself so much that he didn't like anybody who liked him.
Mm.
That's sad.
So he was, also depressed.
very much so. He spent the summer of 81 at Martha's Vineyard, where he owned a property. He was encouraged by his wife, Judy, and Dan to clean up his act. And it did. It worked for that summer.
I mean, get your shit together, dude.
Yeah, I mean, it kept him away from the crooked people in his life that had pretty much been hanging around him for selfish reasons, whether it be drugs or to get into places.
Money.
You know, money, whatever. Dan later said that they had a beautiful summer that year. But when John moved back to Hollywood, his demons returned, and he began working with writer Don Novello on a screenplay entitled Noble Rot. I don't know what it was about. Don't know if I'd order it.
Yeah,
from Blockbuster or whatever. I don't know, but...
Oh, is Blockbuster even still around?
No, but in the 80s it was.
Oh.
So Don and John had a lot of work to do, and John would stay awake all night in order to keep up with his deadlines.
So he was probably like, ooh, I'll just do a little coke to stay awake.
Yeah, and then a lot of coke and a lot of coke. And
just kept getting bigger and bigger.
So obsessed with getting the job done, John would, like, lock himself in his room at the Chateau Marmont Hotel. I sound like a ding-dong saying that because it's French. But it's Chateau Marmont.
The Chateau.
Chateau Marmont. It's a hotel. It's the hotel that he was staying in when he was in Hollywood. And he would lock himself in his room and work all night long. Work. I mean, I'm sure he did. Like, cocaine. Yeah. I mean, people seem like busybodies. I'm sure he was coming up with great ideas. After undertaking all that work in for Noble Rot, the studio bosses were not happy with the script. So, like, John was extremely upset about that. He had spent all that time working on it, and they
got addicted to coke again.
Yeah, I guess it didn't help. Added to that, he had been offered a role in the movie called Joy of Sex, which he would have got a lot of money for. But his character wasn't likable, and that made him feel, like, really conflicted because he was used to being so liked on screen. John found the experience of negotiating his future, like, exhausting. And, I mean, pretty much he just wanted to play. He didn't want to work. He wanted to play.
All right. I mean, don't we all?
I mean, don't we all? But we also all know better than that. But that's also what made him so great, you know? I mean, he had no filter. He was playful, but he was playful all the time.
Yeah.
And that's what hurt him, because when he started to get all these responsibilities, he couldn't handle it, and so he was addicted to drugs. Or he couldn't, when he was trying to write, he felt that the only way he could do it was if he was fucked up.
Kind of like this podcast.
You know what? A lot like this podcast. I am still nervous. Episode 5, still nervous. I don't know why. Because nobody's listening. In order to get some distance from himself and from Hollywood, John went back to New York, where his wife still lived. And he left his troubles behind in Hollywood, thinking, you know, his wife,
she's a good woman for standing beside him.
I know. They lived in different...
I mean, do they have kids?
No.
Mm-mm. Maybe she had her own career in New York.
She did. She was also on National Lampoon's.
Oh.
She did a lot for them, so I don't know exactly what, but I know that they went together on that show. And so she was in the business somehow. But apparently her business was in New York, and John's was in L.A. He did, though, admit that he was not the best of company, and the visit was stressful. And after only about a week, he returned to California because he could not get it out of his head. He had to sort things out with the screenplay. So arriving back at the Chateau Marmont, John seemed stressed and unhappy and lonely, and they said that it seemed like something plagued the actor, like, noticeably melancholy.
Okay.
The hotel manager, Suzanne later told the Los Angeles Times
Ubaluba?
That, I can't pronounce it, Georgian? Anyway, that lady, she later told the Los Angeles Times that the actor seemed to be driving himself incredibly hard. She quoted, "He seemed like he was very, very tired," she said. I'm going to talk about the Chateau Marmont Hotel. It's so weird that I just go French for like 0.05 seconds.
Sometimes, like when you go British.
Sometimes, yeah, I do that. Now I'm going French. If you've gone to LA, it's on the Sunset Boulevard, and it's like it's at kind of out of place because it's just this sort of giant castle on a hill.
And still there.
Oh yeah. Oh, definitely. It makes you want to know more about it. That's how it looks. Like when you drive by, you're like all these, you know, you've got the Viper Room and the Roxy and all these bars and like bulls you can ride on outside, and then this castle. So you, I mean, just driving by it, you want to know more about it.
You can for like probably $4,000 a night.
Or by listening to this podcast, because I'm about to tell you.
All right.
It is located at 8221 Sunset Boulevard. It's a luxurious hotel that you can stay in if you had a lot of money.
Cha-ching.
The guest book has like everybody in it. Marilyn Monroe, Jean Harlow, Clark Gable, Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, everybody that was anybody.
Not us.
Not me. It's very expensive. In 1926, Fred Horowitz, a prominent LA attorney, chose that site to construct an apartment building. He had recently traveled to Europe for inspiration and returned with photos of a Gothic chateau along the Loire. No, I'm not even gonna try that. Loire River? L-O-I-R-E? Loire? Mm. He's a L-A lawyer on the Loire River.
If you know how to pronounce that, send us a video clip.
Yes, put it up on YouTube. Tag us if you can. In 1927, Horowitz commissioned his brother-in-law. Actually, I don't know for sure that it was that person, because I've seen a couple of different designers of the building, and that's not even important.
He got somebody.
He got somebody to design the 7-story L-shaped building that had 63 rooms and suites, and it was based on those French photos that he took. The building was finally completed in 1929. When deciding upon a name for the building, Chateau Sunset and Chateau Hollywood were rejected in favor of Chateau Marmont. And Marmont was there's like this little kind of side street, tiny thing that goes right in front of it, and that's the name of that street.
Oh.
Marmont. On February 1st, 1929, the chateau opened its doors as the newest residence of Hollywood. The newspapers described it as Los Angeles' newest, finest, and most exclusive apartment house, superbly situated, close enough to the active businesses to be accessible, and far enough away to ensure quiet and privacy. That's a big headline.
Yeah.
But due to the high rents and the inability to keep long-term tenants during the Depression, Horowitz had to sell the building, and he sold it to Albert Smith for $750,000.
What a steal.
Probably, because right now it's probably worth gazillions.
Right. You like that gazillion one.
It just maximizes the effect, I think. In 1931, Chateau Marmont was converted into a hotel, and the apartments became suites with kitchens and living rooms. So it was super fancy. Yeah. It also was designed to be earthquake-proof, and it survived major earthquakes in 33, 53, 71, 87, and 94. 9 Spanish cottages, as well as a swimming pool, were built next to the hotel in the 1930s, and then were eventually acquired by the hotel in the 40s.
So when they were built, they weren't part of the hotel.
Right. And then they kind of took over that land whoever wanted to sell it. In the 40s, the hotel served as an air raid shelter.
Oh.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
The hotel was acquired and restored again in 1990, and they updated the Depression era theme to a more modernized design, but it still preserved its character. So it was still classy, but just updated.
Gotta get with the times.
Well, yeah. You don't want it to really be dusty. You just want it to look dusty.
Yeah.
It was designed to create an illusion that the hotel had been untouched, notwithstanding renovations. Now the hotel prides itself on being the place to be whoever you want to be. Harry Cohn once said that, he was a Columbia Pictures executive. He said that if you had to get in trouble, you might as well do it at the Chateau Marmont.
I mean, so if you stay there, can you even go inside without having a reservation?
Probably not.
Or an invite. Because otherwise people would just be walking through all the time.
Well, maybe they do. I don't know. But they also have, like, separate bungalows. They have, I don't think you'd get much farther than the lobby.
Yeah.
But you probably could go in there. Well, John's previous visit to the hotel was low-key, work-heavy. This time, when he came back, he was determined to party. He called Kathy Evelyn Smith, a woman he had been friends with for several years, and she was also known as a backup singer and a groupie. I think that's how she got into the business.
How do you get that kind of job?
You follow and stalk, mm-hmm. in not a scary way. She was also rumored to be a drug dealer. From the moment John arrived in Los Angeles, he called Kathy and they hung out, and according to Kathy, they spent the evening together, platonically, she claimed, drinking wine and inhaling and injecting cocaine at the Chateau Marmont. On March 4th, 1982, John called his wife Judy from his room at the hotel to give her news about his work, and from his tone during the call, Judy was sensing that he wasn't happy with the way things were going. There was nothing she could do from New York to make him feel better, so she just stayed on the phone and listened to her husband's worries as he apologized for his behavior and told her that he loved her. And that was the last time Judy ever spoke to her husband.
Aww.
I know. That evening, John went to a restaurant with Kathy before ending up in the VIP section of the Roxy.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal there. A lot of people got their start there. It's on Sunset.
It's on what?
It's on Sunset.
Oh, I thought you said Southside.
He became extremely intoxicated and felt so ill that Kathy had to drive him home and help him into his bungalow at the Chateau Marmont. Once there, he was vomiting in the bathroom, but then when he was done, he proceeded to drink more wine and snort more cocaine.
Well, if you're done throwing up, might as well... You might as well put it back in your system.
It's a major buzzkill. You gotta start over.
Right.
The drug taking continued well into the early hours of the morning, and Kathy later reported that John was pale and sweaty. Like you were here last time.
I was very sweaty here last time.
Were you on cocaine?
I was not.
And wine.
Just Mucinex and...
Still, the night did not end there, and at some point before 3 a.m., Robert De Niro and Robin Williams stopped by.
Oh.
They both arrived separately, but they didn't stay long because they were disturbed by what they found to be going on in the room. Robin, in particular, was said to have thought of Kathy as creepy and wondered why John was hanging out with her. Robin had been battling his own demons, and even though he knew enough about Hollywood to be concerned for John's welfare, he just, mm-hmm. Knew how the business worked, and he was like, it's getting to him.
Yeah.
Before Robin left, he told John to call him if he ever got out of bed again. And what happened later disturbed Robin so much that he was said to have gone cold turkey in order to wean himself off drugs. After Robert and De Niro left, the drugs continued in rampant fashion, and at 6:30 a.m., John took a shower and complained to Kathy that he felt cold. He turned up the heat but still felt sick. Then at around 8 a.m., they ordered room service, but John fell asleep before the room service came. Kathy, who was still awake, took delivery of the order and later said that at this point, she noticed that John was breathing in a very erratic way, like he was wheezing and he was visibly shaking.
But she didn't call 911?
Not at this point. Nope, never. She was concerned enough to wake him up and later described that he was not happy about it and assured her that he was okay. He drank a glass of water, then did some more drugs, like you do,
yeah.
And then fell back to sleep. But not before asking Kathy to stay in bed with him because he didn't want to be alone. So I wonder if maybe he felt impending doom coming on.
Maybe.
She stayed for a while, but then she had personal business to attend to and took his car keys and left in his Mercedes.
Well, let's just take his car.
Well, he wasn't going to notice. He was in bed. He didn't need it. What happened next is something of a mystery because it's unclear as to whether or not John ever regained consciousness. But what we do know is that his personal trainer, William Wallace, tried to contact John several times, but because he wasn't able to get through to him, he went to the hotel and at 12:15 p.m. Upon entering the room, Wallace discovered John lying in the bed, dead.
So Kathy left around 8, and the trainer showed up around 12:30?
At 12:15. He summoned the hotel security, and together they took the actor's body from the bed and tried to revive him, but it was too late. Paramedics later commented that John was probably dead by 10 a.m. Mm-hmm.
So if Kathy would have just called 911...
She didn't know, really, that anything was wrong.
Well, I mean, I guess he didn't.
I mean, I get her. Okay. I get it, but she's also on drugs, too. Like,
yeah.
I don't really know the effect that drugs has on a person, but I know it whacks your brain up. It makes your brain all crazy. And so the fact that she was messed up, she probably, I don't know, maybe she didn't even think of it. Like, he was still breathing.
Just say no, kids.
Yeah. Just say no to Kathy Smith, you guys. By the time Kathy arrived back at the hotel, police had surrounded the building, and she made the mistake of driving up a one-way street in the wrong direction and was stopped by the police. She mentioned, though, that it was the route that John told her to take, so they were like, okay, she was with John.
Yeah.
So they arrested her, or well, they seized her and took her away for questioning. And they didn't even tell her until hours later that John was dead, so she didn't even really know why she was there. It was during the police interview that the coroner later said that Kathy presented officers with a blackened spoon and syringe, which she had taken from the hotel in an effort to keep the drug-taking a secret from the hotel's cleaning service. I guess you get paranoid.
Yeah.
She had not cleaned the room, though, as much as she thought, because when officers went on the scene, they found a quote-unquote green leafy substance in a
oregano.
Yeah, it was probably just stuff for his spaghetti. And hand-rolled cigarettes, papers, and traces of white powder on a dresser. Kathy was released after questioning, but rather than just choosing to fade in the background, she did an interview with ABC News to talk about John's last days.
Well, of course. I mean, she wants to get her name out there.
Well, and she wants money.
Yeah.
The interview was not particularly revealing, and while she freely admitted that it wasn't totally out of the question that John overdosed, she wasn't admitting to witnessing him taking drugs that night. Because she didn't want to get in trouble.
Well, yeah. Or say she provided them.
Or that. Added to that, her lawyer stopped the interview from asking about any of the rumors of her drug dealing before finally jumping to his feet and calling a stop to the show when Kathy was asked about rumors of drug taking among John and his friends. The Los Angeles County Coroner, Thomas Noguchi, which is a very famous coroner if you watch true crime-y, murder-y LA shows. I mean, Thomas Noguchi was the coroner forever. Yeah, he was a big deal. He was assigned to the case, and when he was performing the autopsy, he declared that the procedure had not yet established the cause of death. Further tests were ordered, and at that point, police attested that they could see no foul play involved. By the time the news had been wired around the world, John's friend Dan Aykroyd went to Judy's home to break the news. She was upset and confused and immediately tried to get answers from the police. However, during an interview with People magazine years later, she recalled that the police were not helpful and that one officer actually asked her what she expected. He said the guy was a junkie. Don't say that to the wife.
Right. Have some compassion.
I know. On March 8th, 1982, sources at the coroner's office revealed that it was believed that John died of a drug overdose. Rumors surfaced that his arms had needle marks and prominent veins, and one source disclosed that he had been freebasing cocaine, and that's like the purest and most potent form of the drug.
Okay.
And they said that he was injecting it that night. On March 10th, the coroner's office revealed that John's death had been caused by a mixture of heroin and cocaine, aka speedball, that was injected into his veins. Samples had been taken from the room, had been found to be those drugs. The levels of narcotics in his bodies were described as extremely large and substantial. But on the death certificate, it's listed as acute cocaine and heroin intoxication as the cause of death. And it was registered as an accident.
An accidental overdose.
Basically, yeah. I mean, I'm sure he didn't. I don't feel like he did it on purpose.
Right.
In the days and months ahead, a full investigation was conducted, but it was felt that his passing was just another Hollywood tragedy, and there was no one to blame but John himself. However, all this changed when Kathy, who was by then living in Canada, gave an interview to the National Enquirer, you know, the
reliable
most reliable source. She apparently said that she had injected John with a speedball, which is the mixture of cocaine and heroin, shortly before she left. The news caused this firestorm, and police were responding, saying
like, why would she do that?
Well, I guess she didn't think she was going to get in trouble, but she did. And then she decided that she was going to sue the National Enquirer for falsifying information that she told them. But the National Enquirer was like, no, we paid $15,000 for the interview, and she was also taped during the interview, so the audio was confirmed.
Well, and she didn't seem like the sharpest crayon on the box.
Right. The investigation continued when, with police examining new evidence and re-interviewing friends and those who could possibly provide a substantial lead, and finally they decided that Kathy should be charged with John's murder.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I
don't know. I mean, yes and no. Like, would she be charged of... I don't know. Well, he did them himself. Like, he wanted it. He probably asked for it.
That's true. But if he was throwing up and then doing more drugs, I don't know if I would just leave someone laying in a bed and...
See, that's why you're the logic. I think John and Kathy were a destructible mixture because she was just like... It was like two Emilys.
She just didn't give a shit.
Yeah, no, it was like me and me hanging out. We're just like, yeah, let's do more. We always need
a chasser.
Everybody needs a chass.
Aww.
The investigation continued with police examining new evidence and re-interviewing friends. A trial was ordered and Kathy was charged with second-degree murder. And 13 felony charges related to providing and giving heroin and cocaine to John.
Well, why didn't she get charged with that to begin with if she was already a drug dealer back then?
Because they couldn't prove that, but it was when she admitted that she was selling him drugs that they were able to get her.
Oh.
In the end, it was decided that Kathy should serve 15 months in prison beginning in December 1986... almost 5 years after John's death. 2 months before John died, he said in an interview with Rolling Stone, "I don't do more drugs than any other schmuck out there in public. And, I like doing it. I'm just noticed more than anyone else."
So, I mean, he's admittedly saying, "I do drugs."
And he's also admitting that everybody else does too, but the camera's on me. And that's why it seems like I'm this bad drug addict when... I do it as much as anybody else. So that's the fall and rise of John Belushi.
What a good story. Well, I mean, yeah. Not really. I mean, he ended up dying.
Far too soon.
Yes.
Far too soon.
And he was 33.
Only 33.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he died in Bungalow 3.
Oh, weird.
I know.
333.
It's weird. I want you to go ahead and take over the microphone, but before we do so, we need to do another shot. I'm kind of scared. I'm not going to lie. Mm. This thing is potent. Okay, guys. Here we go. Let's get buzzer. Mm. Oh, my God, you guys. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Yeah, we do not recommend this shot this week.
It burns. It burns. Ugh.
Okay.
All right, Chas. I want to hear all about Chris Farley. Let's do it.
All right. Well, Christopher Crosby Farley was born on February 15th, 1964 in Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, he just had his birthday.
Yeah. His father, Thomas John Farley Sr., owned an oil company.
Ooh.
And it's weird that they live in Wisconsin and he owned an oil company.
But... yeah, he wasn't Texan.
No, he wasn't Texan. And his mother, Mary Ann, was a housewife. He had four siblings, three brothers, and one sister. Two of his brothers are actors and appeared in the wedding scene in Tommy Boy.
Oh, and that was one of his biggest
commercial films. Yes.
Yep. Yep.
And his brother, Kevin Farley, made an appearance in every one of Chris's films.
Oh, I remember that.
And just a little side note, Chris's cousin, Jim, is the CEO and chairman at Ford Motor Company in Europe.
How funny is it?
Yeah.
Callahan Auto Parts, Ford Motor Company.
Yes. So Chris grew up Roman Catholic, and it was noted that Chris would always make sure that he made it to Mass.
Oh.
So Chris's mother, Mary Ann, mm-hmm. had a strong no-swearing policy.
Oh.
And so Chris made up the phrase, holy shnikes, oh. as a child. And
he says that in Tommy Boy.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's funny.
Yes.
Huh.
So Chris spent many summers at Red Arrow Camp near Minocqua, Wisconsin, as a camper, and then later he was a counselor.
Aww.
And kids would make fun of Chris for his weight, and the way that he dealt with it was he would just make fun of himself,
mm-hmm.
and then people laughed. He That's got right. friends.
That's right.
And I think I kind of mentioned that earlier when you were talking about John.
Yeah, exactly.
So one day, Chris saw National Lampoon's Animal House with his mm-hmm. dad, and he loved the way that John Belushi made his dad laugh. And so Chris thought that maybe he could do comedy.
And it was for his dad.
Yeah.
I didn't know that's kind of where this sprouted.
Yeah.
Aww.
Chris did end up going to Marquette University and graduated in 1986 with a degree in communications and theater.
Yeah.
And while he was at Marquette, he played rugby, but that's where he really discovered a love for comedy.
Oh.
After graduation, Chris went and worked for his father at the Scotch Oil Company back in Madison, Wisconsin. But he would also do shows at the Arc Improv Theater in Madison, as well as the Improv Olympic Theater in Chicago. So I'm not for sure how far Madison and Chicago are from each other, but it kind of sounded like he was doing both.
Right, right.
Chris then got a job at Chicago's Second City Theater, and initially he was just part of their touring group, but then he was eventually promoted to the main stage. And according to Farley, Second City's director, Del Close, instructed him to try to kill the audience. Fucking kill them. I want you to make them laugh so hard that they vomit and choke on their own vomit. And that suited Farley, like, to a T.
Yep.
Yeah. And so he pretty much followed that advice his whole career. Chris was discovered doing his stand-up comedy in Chicago by Lorne Michaels, who's the producer of SNL. And shortly afterwards, Chris was casted for the 1990-91 season of SNL.
Yes, he was. And he was brilliant.
Yes.
That was such a great season.
And just a little side note, he actually dated Lorne's assistant, Aaron,
oh, really?
Yeah, Marloni, who then became a writer on the show.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. Well, Chris was a part of SNL. He was known as the Bad Boys of SNL Club.
Just like John.
Well, the other members being Adam Sandler, Rob Schneider, and David Spade.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you watch SNL from the early 90s and you know these guys.
Yeah, exactly. Our generation.
And then another little tidbit was that Adam, Rob, Dave, and Chris, they were all planning on doing a movie together called Grown Ups, which was put on hold. And then 10 years after Chris's death, they put it out. And Chris's part was played by Kevin James.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So while working at SNL, Chris had smaller roles like in Wayne's World, Coneheads, Airheads. And some of the characters that he played on SNL was Fat Guy in a Little Coat.
Oh, yeah.
Chippendales.
Down by the River.
Yep. Gap Girls. Lunch Lady. And a little thing, a bit about the Van by the River skit. So it was based on one of Chris's good friends named Matt Foley. Foley, during a troubled period, actually lived in a van down by the river. And so in the early years when Chris was doing this skit on SNL, mm-hmm. he would use other members of the audience and say that's what his name was, that he knew from the audience. But then Matt actually came to a show, and from that point forward, he always used the name Matt Foley when he did that.
That's crazy.
Sketch, yeah.
It's so fun to, because I saw it all on the surface, but I didn't know anything that was going on behind the scenes. That's so fun.
Well, Chris was, like, well known for his pranks, especially around SNL. And
I love pranks. I am the one that at work, I super glued a quarter to the ground.
And then, oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
And so right before the entrance to our building, and I got to watch so many people trying to grab that thing up, and it was amazing.
Is it still there?
No, I think
super glue does not last forever, folks.
It doesn't last through the winter.
It's not weatherproof.
And then you'd hear like stories about it, like so and so was walking in the building today
and tried to grab the quarter. That's funny.
Yeah. Anyway, go on.
Okay, well, Chris was known for his pranks, and him and Adam Sandler would often make late night prank calls from SNL offices. Sandler would speak in an old woman's voice, and Chris would often fart into the phone.
Of course.
Yes. And Chris was seen mooning cars from limousines and was also known to get naked and do various stunts for laughs.
Sure.
So Chris Rock once claimed that he probably saw Farley's private parts more than Chris's girlfriend did.
That's funny.
Yeah.
My mom, there's a fountain in town where you're not allowed to quote-unquote wade in it. But that's what my mom had a best friend, and her daughter was the same age as we were. And after we got done wading in the fountain, we'd be all wet because we waded with our clothes on. So we'd take our clothes off, and my mom had a station wagon. So all the way home, we would be mooning other drivers from the back of the station wagon because we were buck naked. But we were also, you know, like six.
Could be like child pornography.
I know, right? How did we not get in trouble for that?
Chris was fired from SNL along with Adam Sandler in 1995. Really? Yeah.
They were fired?
Yeah, I didn't say why. It said that a lot of the guys from his group were fired. And Adam was on, Conan O'Brien, I think, and said that they had gotten fired.
Weird.
And it was 1 year before their contract was to end.
Huh.
So from 19...
What happened there?
Maybe they were just ready to move on.
Probably.
Yeah. So from 1990 to 1995, Chris appeared in 100 episodes of SNL.
Jeez.
In 1995, Chris starred in his first major role, Tommy Boy.
Tommy Boy.
Tommy Boy opened at number one and was his greatest success commercially. Well, he was really good friends with David Spade.
Yeah.
But Chris had a bit of a temper, and on the set of Tommy Boy, he found out that his friend David Spade went out on a night on the town with Rob Lowe and didn't invite him.
Uh-oh.
And he went nuts and stomped on David Spade's hand. Chris would go to star in three additional roles, Black Sheep, mm-hmm. Beverly Hills Ninja,
yep.
and then Almost Heroes, which was released after his death.
Oh.
But he was also Oh, yeah, with Matthew Perry.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's a country western one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I've seen it. I didn't know it was released after his death,
yep,
though.
Yep, after his death. So, Chris was the original choice for Jim Carrey's role in the 1996 The Cable Guy, but scheduling...
Wait, let's just imagine that for a second.
Well, Cable Guy sucks, I think, personally.
I think it's pretty funny.
I think it would have been much better with Chris Farley.
It would have been pretty good with Chris Farley, though. I'm imagining it, and I like it.
Yes. Well, unknown scheduling conflicts...
Yeah.
Didn't work, so he didn't get to star, obviously. Chris led a very wild lifestyle, which included overeating, heavy drinking, mm-hmm. prostitutes, and drug abuse. And he would go to rehab several times, but he would relapse.
For drugs?
And, like...
For drugs or for, like, eating?
Both.
For, like, hookers?
For drugs and overeating. He went to AA and Overeaters Anonymous a lot.
Really?
Chris would seek treatment for obesity and drug abuse 17 times before his death, and that's in a 2-year span.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Crazy.
Wow. He was in it to win it.
Well.
Death, that is.
Yes. Because obviously he couldn't stay on the wagon.
No. Yeah.
following a guest appearance on SNL on October 25th, 1997, there was a visible decline in Farley's health. His voice was hoarse. Mm. His skin was flushed. And, like, he was just the subject of public scrutiny after that. Apparently, during the rehearsals that week for SNL, he would show up already drinking. And Michael Lorne was afraid that Chris would screw up and the whole thing was going to be a mess.
Yeah, because they do it live.
Yeah. And Chris was like, nope, I'm in it. I'm fine. And he even told a friend that it hadn't been a good week for him, like, afterwards.
Was it good? Are you going to tell me about it?
It wasn't that great.
Okay.
Just some of the time he wasn't very funny. He kind of seemed out of it.
Yeah.
But other cast members were able to, like, scoop in to, and save the day.
Yep. Gotcha.
Just weeks before his death, Chris had made a stop at a detox center in Minneapolis. And apparently he had went to this detox center in Minneapolis many times because somebody had joked that they should just name a wing after him.
Really?
And,
That's not funny.
He did this 17 times in 2 years. So arriving home to Chicago on December 11th, just after one night in detox, an out-of-shape Chris surprised and worried friends with a speedy return back from
detox. Like, guess what, guys? Okay.
And just a little tidbit was, at the time of his death, he was only 5'8 and weighed 298 pounds. And he had a really good friend named Jillian Seeley, who they were platonic friends. But she used to be an alcoholic, but she had been sober, I think, for 20 years. And she asked Chris what had made him slip, and Chris said that he just didn't know. Chris's mood the week before his death, he was jolly. It was also Christmas season. He had went to Jillian's Christmas party with her, and she had made the sugar cookies, and he kept calling them alien cookies, and he called her every day to say something about her alien cookies, like, that week. But she could tell, like, he was messed up.
Yeah, obviously.
But he also spent the next few days going to mass at St. Michael's Catholic Church, which she often did, and he also splurged on a decked out Christmas tree from, like, a high-end florist in Chicago.
Is hard.
And he talked about what his life would be like in 1998, his upcoming movie Almost Heroes, and even attended an AA meeting. On December 14th, Chris started a downward spiral. He was out seen bar hopping around Chicago and consuming large quantities of drug and alcohols and hanging out with party girls. That night, he was partying at a downtown Chicago club called Karma, where he raged until about 2 a.m. and then afterwards had a big after party at his house. On Monday, December 15th, Chris dropped by the 38th anniversary party for Second City. And they just said he was his usual lively self. He was drinking, but not drunk. But then later that night, he was seen on a pub crawl.
So he got drunker.
So then on Tuesday, December 16th, Chris blew off a haircut that he had with Jillian, who was just right across the street from his apartment. He lived in the the John Hancock building in Chicago. And another little note is that he lived right next door to Jerry Springer. Yep.
Oh, wow. Comedian's hallway. That's crazy.
So instead of getting his haircut, he called a $300 per hour girl named Autumn. And she alleges that she spent the afternoon with Chris. She says Chris called her around 8:30 a.m. And she says the comedian was smoking pot, drinking screwdrivers, and seemed more interested in her scoring cocaine than any of her services. Autumn says, I don't think he knew what he wanted. You could just tell he was on a rampage. He kept bouncing from room to room. Wednesday, December 17th. I feel like I'm, like, on this Law and Order episode.
Timeline.
Chris called a friend and was talking about the upcoming New Year again. And he was so excited to see his family over Christmas. And the friend brought up how unhealthy Chris had looked during his recent SNL appearance. And Chris responded with, yeah, I'm working on it. And then he also called Jillian. And she could tell he was, quote, out of his mind. And so he had asked her to come over, and she told him, honey, I want you to get some sleep. Chris replied back with, I'll call you in an hour. Jillian didn't go over to Chris's because she didn't want to see his booze bottles and then get angry at him. And like his other friends, she was kind of getting fed up with it because he was going in and out of rehab. And
he, I mean, it's hard to deal with somebody that's messed up all the time.
It's like emotionally straining.
Exhausting. Yeah.
So then on December 18th, 1997, Chris was found dead by his younger brother, John. Chris was found sprawled in the apartment entryway.
Right. That's where he collapsed when... So when Autumn was leaving, he was like, no. He was following her to the door saying, no, don't leave me alone. And that's when he collapsed on the floor. And Autumn was like, you idiot. And she takes a picture of him and leaves. And he was weird. So he had a button-up shirt on, but it was all the way open. And he had his brown khaki pants on. There are pictures of him, his death photos out there. I would recommend looking at those at your own risk because it's affected me for the rest of my life. It's really, really, really sad.
Aww.
I'm not going to post it to our Facebook page or our Instagram page, so you're going to have to Google it yourself.
Google.
It's really sad. But the pictures are everywhere.
An autopsy revealed that Chris had died of a cocaine and morphine overdose and possibly complicated by a culinary condition early that morning. Chris's death is often compared to John Belushi, because he also died at 33 of an accidental drug overdose. Earlier that year, Chris was quoted as saying, did you know that he died at my age this year at 33? Yeah, March 4th, 1982.
So it makes you wonder if, did he do it on purpose?
Well, Chris was once also heard saying, I want to live fast and die young.
He really did want... He embodied everything that John Belushi was.
Chris's private funeral was held at Our Lady, Queen of Peace Catholic Church in his hometown of Madison, Wisconsin. Over 500 people attended his funeral, including many comedians who had worked with him on SNL.
Sure.
Tom Arnold gave the eulogy at the funeral. Huh. But absent at Chris's funeral was David Spade? Who was later quoted as saying that he declined to attend Chris's funeral because he could not be in a room where Chris was in a box.
I understand that.
Chris's remains were entombed at Resurrection Catholic Cemetery in Madison. So after his death, he was awarded star number 2,289 on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh, I didn't know they kept track of that.
Apparently. There's 2,288 people in front of him.
Really?
I didn't know there were that many stars. His star was placed outside the Improv Olympic Theater West, which was a place that Chris had studied and performed. At the time of his death, Chris was worth $5 million, and he was actually the original choice for the voice of Shrek. And he he had actually recorded a majority, 85% of the voiceovers before he died. But they were never publicly released.
He couldn't finish it.
Yeah. Oh, and he was working on many other projects at the time of his death. So he was always terrified. He was terrified of crowds. His outrageous behavior was kind of like a silkscreen where he was afraid if he lost weight, people wouldn't find him funny.
Right.
But he thought nobody would love him. He would never have kids.
Aww.
I know. And hanging in his apartment, he had lots of cheesy clown art.
Really?
Yeah, because he loved cheesy clown art.
How fun is that?
Yeah.
I wonder if he had any John Wayne Gacy's.
Oh, I don't know.
That guy was crazy clown.
So that's everything that I have on Chris Farley.
And it's so crazy how much influence John Belushi had on him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he probably saw John Belushi had this great career. He was funny. He was overweight, but Chris was overweight, and so he thought, well, this guy can do it, made my dad laugh, I could do it.
Exactly. You will be forever in our memories.
And always be known as two of the greatest comedians.
Of all time.
Yes.
All right, guys, that is the conclusion of episode 5.
Yes. Congratulations, Denise.
To Denise.
Yay!
And we already have plans for future prize competitions that will happen in the same format. So stay tuned for those. And also, you guys, if it's not too much trouble, go ahead and rate us in iTunes. the ratings will let other people know whether or not to listen to this podcast. And so if you go out and rate us, I mean, good or bad.
I mean, it gives us feedback, like what we could change.
Yeah.
What you like.
Exactly. So rate us and email us at thebuzzthatwaspodcast@gmail.com. Let us know of any stories that you want us to talk about or any buzz that wasn't.
Or any, if you're just bored and can't sleep one night.
Yeah, we'll read it. We'll read it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.